Hello and welcome to the Ropescast, the independent voice of the Middle East. I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
And I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmed. ROPES stands for the Regional Organization for Peace, Economics and Security. We are working towards a post-conflict Middle East by connecting forward-thinking Israeli and Palestinian emerging leaders with like-minded peers from across the region and promoting peaceful solutions and regional integration. If you're looking for more information on ROPES, you can visit our website, ropes.org.
Our very special guest today is Kamal Masharawi. Kamal is a Palestinian entrepreneur and peace activist, born and raised in Gaza. He has written previously about his and his family ordeal during the war and their fraught escape from the Gaza Strip in The New Yorker and in The New York Times. Also, Kamal is our ROPES very own alumni. Hello, Kamal. Ramadan Karim, and welcome to the ROPEScast.
Hi, Ksenia, and hi, Ibrahim. So great to see you, and I'm really happy I'm participating to the ROPEScast. I've been always ambitious about the things you do, and I'm really happy that I got the chance today to speak to you.
It's our honor.
Thank you so much, and it's really great to have you on the show. For starters, please, Kamal, let's maybe tell us a little bit about your personal story. You are not in Gaza now, but you left it already way into the war, and your experience is really extraordinary. So for the sake of those who didn't read about your exodus from Gaza with your family, could you please tell us a little bit about it? How was it for you and for your family?
Yes, thank you, Ksenia, for this great question. It's actually a good idea to begin the conversation with my experience being in Gaza during the war and the hard work and hard efforts we did in order to leave. And also, after we left, the plans we have and how we were able to deal with this amount of trauma and you know, pain that happened because of the war. So on October 7th, I was supposedly visiting Gaza for a week for a family occasion and also to check our work in the Strip. And then we woke up on October 7th and things, you know, miserably transformed from normal life to hell. Hamas began the attack, and then Israel did, had to do some sort of deal with what Hamas did, and then things actually got worse and worse and worse. So on October 7th, the war started. We weren't able to go out of our houses. We were locked, and then a few days after that, you know, the escalation started. Huge bombardment, very excessive bombing of around us everywhere. And then just a few days after that, we had to leave our houses from Gaza City to the south. And then the whole process of the chaotic process actually started. We had to leave our home from Gaza City to the south at the first time on October 13th. And we actually had to do that. And we went to Khan Yunis and also stayed in the middle area for a few hours before that. But also it was so unsafe for us to stay in the south. The bombardment, bombing and explosions didn't stop anywhere in Gaza during the evacuation. So we stayed in Khan Yunis for a few weeks, and then we felt so unsafe, so targeted, so in danger, because people were actually suspecting that Israel invaded Gaza from the south, Israel invaded Gaza from the north. So a lot of rumors were going on. So we felt so unsafe, and we had to go back to Gaza. So we went back to Gaza a few days before the ground invasion happened. And we went back to our home and stayed for a few days. And we woke up that morning and saw the Israeli tanks invading the villages of Gaza City. And just it took them a few days to be on our doorstep when we actually were in the battle, because that neighborhood was full of snipers. And, you know, as a lot of people who live in the city, we used to get like very limited amount of food or water on a daily basis. So we have to go up in the morning, start hunting for food or water. So it was a daily process. So we couldn't store any amount of food or water. And then since the ground invasion happened, our supply just stopped, and we weren't able to get food or supply. So when the IDF troops came to our doorstep. It was a battle, like shooting everywhere, explosives, bombing, tanks. So it was really difficult to be at home, seeing all that happens. And my home is just 500 feet from the Shifa Hospital. And you know, the operation was huge, and the troops were, you know, doing a lot of activity in that area. And because of it's an active battle, like our home or the place I was sheltering in was hit and was affected by this bombardment and by this shooting. So we stayed for 8 days during the ground invasion, and we ran out of everything. We ate all the expired food. We ate all the ruined food. We ate the trees leaves. But we ran out of everything. And the kids and people started to get sick because of hunger. And we had to leave. We had to leave our home. And so we contacted the UN and asked them if it's possible to make us out of our homes. It took them 3 days to make the coordination. And after 3 days, we were able to leave the home, and they give us a certain route to walk through in order to leave to the south. And we had to walk all the way down. And unfortunately, we took that route. And on the way there, some of the troops didn't know about our story that we're coming. So they started to shoot at us. And, you know, it was so terrifying to be in the middle of the street between the rubbles, between the bodies. And then you see the bullets being, you know, shot at you. It's just not easy. And, you know, because we had also very like elderly people walking with us, and we were a lot, like a lot of kids, a lot of people. And it's a pretty long walk. So we had to walk from our house to Khan Yunis, which is 20 kilometers or even more. But we were able to do it. But unfortunately, on the way to the south, there was a checkpoint between the north of Gaza and the south of Gaza. And then we had to go through it. And one of my cousins was taken on that point, and we don't know anything about him since November 18th, the date when we left. We made it to the south. We stayed there for a few days. And once we were able to be in Khan Yunis, a lot of people like who we know across the globe were actually trying to get us out of the city. And luckily, we succeeded after 8 days in Khan Yunis. So we woke up that morning and we saw our name on the list. We head to Rafah crossing, and we left Gaza City. And just the ceasefire happened a day after that. But actually, when the ceasefire was over, the place we were staying in Khan Yunis was invaded. So all the people in Khan Yunis were asked to leave, including the people we were staying with. So we were so lucky that we made it out of Gaza City at the beginning, and then and we made it out of the strip. It's a miracle, you know, not everybody can do. And maybe as you hear, crazy numbers, maybe people have to pay $5,000 or even more in order to leave. And this is so scary, you know. It means that if you have the money, you can leave. If you don't have the money, you're just left there to die, you know.
Yeah.
To whom do you pay?
Yeah. Can you expand on that a little bit? What happens? Like, how do people leave when they are able to leave? What's that process?
So there's a company in Egypt that's responsible for that. So they have to have someone in Egypt who has $5,000 in U.S. dollars to go to the company office and pay it for that person to leave. So if we were nine people, and if we decided to leave, that's gonna be $45,000 in order for us to leave. But we were so lucky that we didn't have to pay. But I know a lot of people who had to pay in order to leave, and which costs them thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's absurd how some people are making profit off of the misery of the people of Gaza and the Palestinian people. It's absolutely horrendous to hear. And now that you're out of Gaza, do you hear any news from there now, from friends, family? You mentioned your cousin who was at the checkpoint. Are there any news from him since? What's happening right now over there?
And is there a communication? How can you communicate with them?
Well, that's a really good question. Since the war started, the service and network was massively affected and impacted, and it's no longer working. But luckily, people are able to install eSIMs that actually connects to Israeli service providers. So, but they have to go up high, like to the sixth or like seventh floor buildings in order to catch this network. So a lot of people actually got those eSIMs and were able to get data service from Israeli companies. And that's the only way we could call them. And do I have connection with them? Yes, I have connection with probably every person I know in Gaza. It's hard. It takes me hours to make this connection, but I keep checking on them just to make sure that they don't need anything. Well, they are in need, but like I try my best to help them. We donated a lot of funds, and we were able to send a lot of food packages, but it's just ineffective because the need is huge. Like it's a massive need of mass starvation. So we can't actually fix everything, but we're just trying our best that people we know and we love and we care about is not dying of hunger. I lost two aunts and one uncle because of the starvation. They're old and there is no medicine, there's no food, so they're dying, you know. And I don't want this to happen to everybody. I try my best to help them. And you know, I can't even sleep day and night. I'm on the news checking and seeing what's actually happening and if there's a way I could help with. We actually also help a lot of families who are locked in their house because of the like active battles, and we contacted the UN, we contacted the ICRC for them. But it's just so unorganized and so ineffective to speak to such agencies at like a really difficult time. And also for my cousin who was taken on November 18th, I tried my best to talk to like attorneys, advocates in Israel, and a lot of NGO, civil society organizations, but it's just so ineffective. Nobody can know anything about it. Like a lot of people are saying that Israel is making a hidden presence somewhere in Beersheba, but it's just all rumors. I don't have any piece of information. If he's alive, if he's dead, where is he now? Nobody knows anything about it.
Kamal, I wanted to ask you about the public mood, because, you know, it's very difficult for the journalists and also for the rest of us to gather information on what is really happening in Gaza. And you see, sometimes, you know, Hamas is airing, you know, some videos of support for it. And sometimes you have the Israeli news showing some dissent and protest, you know, against the Hamas and so on. But what is basically, you know, like from what you gather, what do people feel about the war, about Hamas, about Israel?
Well, Ksenia, as you know, like maybe better than I do about how divided the Palestinian community is between people who actually support Hamas and people who actually support the PLO and people actually who want peace. And this division is even more clear and obvious since this war started. Like a lot of people are actually want Hamas to take over the area, and a lot of other people actually don't want Hamas to continue, and they want the PLO and Fatah to take over the strip, and other people want some sort of foreign country to come and control Gaza. So it's pretty hard for us to actually know what is the majority, like who's actually the majority. But from my perception, I believe that a lot of people are actually feeling that they are betrayed because they're being collectively punished because of what Hamas did on October 7th, including me as a person. I'm a peace activist. I work in rebuilding. I work in rehabilitation. But since this war started, I feel that I'm betrayed. I'm left behind. Nobody's able to protect me or protect my property or protect my family. So a lot of people actually share the same feeling I have. And I'm probably less affected by this, but a lot of people actually started to be more depressed about the peace process or depressed about Israel's position or depressed about what the US role is during this conflict. And since this amount of depression happening to people, people are turning to be more radical. You know, people are more progressive. And that's actually the case. That's why you see a lot of people are saying, okay, if Israel is not doing anything, the US is not even taking our side, or there is no any actually clear nation that is standing with the Palestinian people and during this difficult time. So it is what it is. I'm turning to be more radical, which is actually so frustrating, because like the long years, like that peace was some sort of prevailing, we started to feel that it's we're starting from scratch again and again, and it's no longer the case pre-October 7th. So that's how the Palestinian community looks like in Gaza. And let me tell you that Hamas is really smart dealing with the propaganda. They know how to market themselves very well. And probably a lot of emotional people are listening to their propaganda. That's why you'll see a lot of people supporting them. At a time where many people feel that Israel is not protecting the civilian population. So it's they are only left with one option. My thoughts is Israel should have protected the civilians at the beginning of the war by giving them camps somewhere in Beersheba or somewhere in Ashdod or somewhere around Gaza in a way that they will feel that Israel is someone who's taking their side or a strategic partner towards peace building. But that's not the case. People are displaced because of Israel. People are sleeping in tents. People are starving. People are don't have medical treatment. And that's all because of what Israel is doing against them. That's why they feel that Israel can be a strategic partner for long-term peace strategy, you know? So I don't know who to blame as much as I actually know that there are better things that can be done in order to ensure that people still have the belief that peace should happen in the region.
And, you know, what can be done to improve the situation, and to elevate the suffering of the civilians of Gaza, if there's more humanitarian aid, I mean, would that be the right solution? I mean, the last time I checked with someone from Gaza, the one little bag of wheat costs right now 45 shekel. Because a lot of the humanitarian aid gets also controlled either by Hamas or sometimes by other people, because it's such a situation where it's people are desperate and even people among themselves are fighting for food. So what would be the way to elevate the suffering of the people who can't, defend for themselves?
Well, that's a really good question, Ibrahim. And the answer for that is should be complying with the international humanitarian law. Like in any conflict around the world, like the civilian people should be outside of everything. So in order to protect them, they should be put aside. You know, if you have a huge operation, massive operation against Hamas, it's your right to do that because you are an affected country. But you have to put the civilians in a safe place. You have to ensure that they're not harmed, they're not displaced. They're not, even if the displacement is urgent, you have to find them a way or a place where they can go to be safe and not affected or not starved or not die of hunger. Or if you fail to do all of that, that's actually where the problem happens. Okay, you're talking about humanitarian aid. We saw a lot of videos, people being targeted while getting the humanitarian aid. I saw people who are dead with wheat in their hands or food packages in their hands. That's actually how you're not protecting the population. So the first thing you need to do is put them aside, find them a safe place to stay, make sure that they get the food and water and the treatment they need, and then you can pursue your operation. That's from the eyes of the international humanitarian law. If you're not complying with this, that's actually a problem. You have to be persecuted for this. If you fail to do all this, there are still measures where you can ensure that the civilian population is not affected, or you should not block the humanitarian aid that's actually going to them. The problem is the humanitarian is very, very limited, very, it does not exist compared to the population who are in Gaza City now. And also, and like the things we see about like blocking the humanitarian aid or even targeting people who are waiting for the humanitarian aid makes us feel that, you know, this is a horrible thing happened that shouldn't happen. So we're trying our best to stop this blocking and find other ways that we can actually put more humanitarian aid. But I'll tell you, it's so hard because people who are on the other side are actually not cooperating and don't believe that humanitarian aid is a necessity. So, which makes our job so much harder.
Yeah, I mean, It sure is a difficult situation, and you know, there are like almost no real like right answers right now. Like, you know, it's always a question of what should be done, and it's always a unknown.
Kamal, I know that these days you and a few of your family members and friends, you are trying to promote the idea of bringing in solar kits into Gaza to address the needs for energy source in the huge camps in Rafah area and beyond. What are the solar kits, and can you explain us briefly about this very interesting idea?
Yes, thank you, Ksenia, for this question. So the solar kits we have is a very small device that can run a tent for 10 hours. Like a normal tent needs lights and a charger for a phone and a radio. That's what actually people need right now. And the kits we have is very suitable for this use. We're trying to coordinate with the US government and other people who are actually in the humanitarian field to be able to allow those devices in. We still face some struggles with coordination and getting permits from them. And it's taking too long, but we're doing our best to allow those kits into Gaza Strip, since it's been probably 5 or 4.5 months since people actually started to live in tents. And I don't think they can stay for longer. And we know the summer is coming, and those tents will turn to be greenhouses. So hot in the summer. So people actually need a solution. And actually, that's why we're thinking about a more developed version of those solar kits that will actually run a fan inside the tent. So we're working on it, and we're hopefully going to get the permits needed for such devices, and also raising enough funds to ensure that those devices are in place. But as I told you before, the humanitarian aid process is so frustrating, so slow, so unimpactful, and you don't have an actual partner to work with, and the answer we always get is a big no. So hopefully this is going to change soon after opening a new sea corridor with Cyprus. And you know, we were in Cyprus and we saw the ships in the port, and we're hopeful that this is going to stop some of the pain that's actually happening in Gaza City and in Gaza Strip in general.
Well, I saw recently some assessment of experts on humanitarian aid that still believe that, I mean, the fastest and the most easy way to bring in huge amounts of humanitarian aid is still by trucks through land corridor. But obviously, you know, due to the complications also in Israel and also in Egypt, this is not happening soon enough. But nevertheless, of course, you know, the seaport idea that Americans are promoting right now, you know, should probably alleviate some part of the misery. However, you know, the question about who will run this place and who will be in charge of distribution of the aid, I think it still remains very crucial. And for now, there is, I think, no definitive answer.
Well, actually, let's get back to the first part of the question. If the sea corridor is more impactful than the trucks, and the answer is yeah, the trucks is way more impactful. But there's one important point about the seaports, which is it's just gonna reduce the amount of time the aid needs to be in Gaza, because you only have one checkpoint, which is it's gonna be in Cyprus, and then things will get inside Gaza without any problem. But for the trucks, they have to be shipped to Egypt and then to Rafah crossing and then to Kerem Shalom and then to Gaza. So yes, it's more impactful to get things through trucks, but also it's faster to get it by the sea. And the second answer is this is still a problem, because you know, there was an idea about connecting with people from social communities to take over the trucks and stuff like that. But anything since, like, it's obvious that Hamas is still exists. You know, it's frustrating, and it's probably, you know, after long war, and we still hear that Hamas still exists in the city or in the south. And since they're still in power, I don't really think any other solution will work out. And probably the easiest and the fastest is to make an agreement, make a ceasefire, make a hostage release agreement, and then start working on humanitarian aid. That's probably what is needed. But like what we actually see now is that the agreement is taking too long. The hostages are still in captivity. The aid is not in, and we don't know when this is gonna last. You know, they say okay, Hamas is done in this area, but that's not actually what's happening in the reality. It's only for the media. And probably the fastest way to solve that is just to find an agreement, because the hostages are still in captivity. People are suffering in the city, and you know, so probably the fastest way to do it is to find a peace agreement or to find a solution for a long-term ceasefire.
Yeah, hopefully we can, you know, see better days in that. And as you say, like Hamas still there, that the situation is still the same in that regard. And, you know, we talked about the problem of distributing humanitarian aid. And how are you thinking of dealing with that particular challenge with the solar kits, you know, to be given directly to the people who are needing them, that the tents get, you know, the equipment it needs? Is that something you're already looking at, or is that something that you're, you know, in the future looking to tackle?
Well, we still have our employees in the city and in the south. So once we are able to bring those kits into Gaza, we will be able to contact our suppliers and find a way to give it to people. You know, solar kits is not as important as food or like wheat or, you know, things people need to eat in order not to die. So probably we're not going to see people coming and rushing to get those solar kits, and it has to be through our channels. But if it's food and people are dying because of hunger, it's just going to be a different story, you know.
Kamal, actually, all of this, you know, it brings me to the question of, you know, what, in your opinion, what is the way out of this crisis? I'm not only speaking about humanitarian, but also politically about the tomorrow, how Gaza should look like in terms of governance, building of the state institutions, you know, what should be the magic formula that will allow also for the security, stability, prosperity, and independence in the end of the day?
Well, that's actually a great question. And before answering that, I want to just list a few principles that we all should agree on before moving on the next day of the war, which is, at the beginning, is the role of civil society organizations and civil society activists in order to prepare the people after the trauma and the aftermath of this war. And secondly, is to ensure diplomacy is deployed in solving the solution. So it doesn't need to be unilateral action from Israel, the US. No, there should be diplomacy. There are nations who are actually happy to help in the rehabilitation process of the people and also for the officials. And this should also be considered in a way to solve the solution. And thirdly, is to ensure that the US and the Israel is not unilaterally acting in a way to solve the solution. No, they also should include civil society, also countries who are happy to help, and also not to make, you know, single decisions. Okay, we need this person to control, we need that person to control. It had to be more open to negotiation, more open to discussion, in a way that we ensure that the Palestinian people in Gaza and West Bank are choosing the government that will last for long, not something that looks like the Palestinian Authority, which lasted for a few years and then collapsed, and as it's miserable as what we see now. So it should be more organized and more open to discussion and more open to diplomacy, in a way that we could ensure that the long-term peace agreement or the long-term Palestinian government will last and will actually solve the solution. We don't want to see any more conflict or any more aggression by either parties, by Israel or by Hamas. I think that's what actually needs to happen in order to solve the solution. And once we achieve the three principles, it's going to be so much easier to actually presume a post-war plan, and also know who exactly needs to run the Gaza Strip and West Bank under one nation. hopefully that's going to be soon. And also, once we have this done, we can actually ensure justice is happened, and people who are responsible for October 7th are persecuted, and people who are actually involved in causing this amount of pain in Gaza are also persecuted, because, you know, that's the only way people will actually be able to live and coexist together and again and again. Hopefully that's what's going to happen, and we'll stop hearing, you know, the amount of miserable things we hear from Gaza and from Israel. And yeah.
Rain.
Inshallah. And, you know, I want to end this with a personal question. You know, actually, what I want to ask you is, unfortunately, this year, Ramadan is, you know, taking place in Gaza in the, you know, the most difficult of situations. But going back, what's the regular spirit of Ramadan is like in Gaza from your memory?
Well, Ibrahim, that's a really tough question to me, you know, because since I left Gaza, and I always ensure that I spend a few days of Ramadan in Gaza to see the vibes, to see the celebrations, to see the actual like people who are living the spirits of Ramadan. You know, we Muslims fast all over the world for the reason that we need to feel the poor people, the people who can't find food, people can't find water. So we stop eating for 12 hours a day just to make sure that we have the same feeling and we have empathy with them. But this Ramadan, they are fasting and we are fasting here as well. And we feel that not everybody actually feeling the pain we face, because people in Gaza have been starving since very, very long time. It's not only for 12 hours a day. They have been fasting for too long. And even if they get food, it's just so limited, that's not going to make them fall. You know, just a few minutes ago, before I started this meeting, I saw an Instagram video about a kid who was injured and lost one of his legs. And he left to Switzerland. And in Switzerland, his doctor got him a sandwich. And the kid asked the doctor if he wants half of that sandwich. And then the doctor started to cry and says, like, even if you are in Switzerland and you have food now and you're able to share your sandwich with me. So that's you know, how difficult it was for people who are actually out of Gaza. And the spirits and celebration in Gaza is always unique. It's people like, that's what when I say people love to live and they deserve it. So we will try so hard to, you know, make the celebrations come again, and inshallah, Ibrahim, you will come and visit Gaza. Also, you, Kasania, visit again and have lunch or dinner at your favorite restaurant. So we're hopeful, we're ambitious, and you know.
Yeah, I can say on the personal note that I had a chance to visit Gaza more than a few times, but it was in the early 2000s until 2000, at the end of 2006. After Hamas came to power, it was already not possible, you know, for the journalist from Israel to go there. But I can tell you, along with always, you know, Gaza was always a difficult place. Yes, it was always a dangerous place. It was always a place of misery, of poverty. But at the same time, you know, I can tell you that indeed, and we discussed it just recently in Rope's special event that we organized in Cyprus. That, for example, I remember this very simple restaurant, but it was actually very good, the matuk, and it specialized on the fish, the small fishes, the Sultan Ibrahim. Yeah, you know, like, you know, all kind of people were to be found there, journalists, but also simple people who just came to eat lunch. And it was also always very jolly. It was a good place, you know. And when I come across the descriptions of Gaza, but this is, of course, you know, it's a topic for another conversation, but still I think that it's important to touch on it, you know, that display Gaza as, you know, this house of death, you know, this place where, you know, nothing but, you know, suicidal bombers live and people who just want to kill everybody. I know for a fact, because I'm one of the few Israelis that visited Gaza, and I know Gazans, that it's not the truth. There are people, different people there. There are good people, there are bad people, like everywhere else, more or less, you know. And Our job today is definitely to protect the civilians, to protect the human lives of people who want to live, who deserve to live, and deserve to live a much better life than they live today.
Amen. Thank you so much, Kamal, for this wonderful conversation.
Thank you very much, Kamal. Alf shukran.
Thank you so much, Ibrahim. Thanks you. Thank you, Ksenia. Hope to see you soon.
Yeah. We pray for peace, and we hope for better times for all of us to meet in Israel, in Gaza, and in every place else.
Amen.
You've been listening to The Ropes Cast, the independent voice of the Middle East. Our guest today was Kamal Masharawi, a Palestinian entrepreneur from Gaza and an alum of Ropes.
We hope you enjoyed The Ropes Cast. Our podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, SoundCloud, and all quality podcast platforms. We are very grateful to all our listeners from the Middle East, Europe, the United States, and other parts of the world. You can support our work by small donation. More details on our website, ropes.org. We invite you to follow ropes.org on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and Threads to find more about our work with the emerging leaders of the Middle East. I'm Ibrahim Abu Ahmed.
And I'm Ksenia Svitlova.
Shalom.
And salam.